Hi there. Official interview started. Cut point. First thing we like to do is, you know, because this is radio, we like to make sure we have the right people in the room. And hopefully by the accents, they'll think that I just grabbed two guys out of Sydney. And so would you identify yourself, please?
This is Dave Faulkner.
Brad Shepard, chick.
And but you see, after all these years, guys, what band are you with?
Hoodoo Gurus, of course, from day one.
Does playing South by Southwest feel like that first tour behind Stone Age Romeos going to college towns?
Well, actually, we've had a little bit of a nostalgia trip already because Karen Glauber, who was the first promotions person we worked with on A&M Records, she doesn't do that anymore, but she was at the airport when we came to Austin. So, yeah, it was like an old reunion for that. And I think
we got lost coming into town yesterday as well, so it's just like old times.
It's impossible to get lost in Austin, but our manager and our bass player managed to contrive together to do that very easily.
I knew when I first heard I Want You Back that it wasn't American or British, but I couldn't put my finger on it, you know, because it had a lot of elements of pop music, but I knew when I first heard it personally there was something different there. You know, just the fade up and it's the way it just suddenly slammed. And it was a hit to me. But when you recorded it, did you have any sense, you know, that it was going to really start out the band? Even though it didn't truly, we're going to get to a lot of the,
yeah.
You know, but to us here in good old America, it was the beginning of the Hoodoo Gurus.
Yeah, well, that song was actually an afterthought on the album. I had it written and had been sort of struggling to get the arrangement to work as far as like the rhythm section. So, it was one of the last things we recorded for Stone Age Romeos. And, of course, you know, we kind of knew it was a special song, but, you know, it's obviously taken on a certain life of its own that's beyond anything we ever imagined.
Were we well into the recording of that album before the rest of us even heard it?
Yeah, as I say, I think it was one of the ones we just kind of, as I say, I had the song waiting to do, and it just hadn't, we'd rehearsed a little bit, I think, and it just hadn't quite gelled. And I just wasn't happy with, you know, mainly, you know, James's part. I just couldn't kind of get the drum pattern to sort of figure to fit support the song properly.
Yeah, as I recall, we were already well into the recording. We were recording it in spades anyway, weren't we? Like a single here and a couple of tracks there. But yeah, I'm pretty sure that I had felt that the record was almost done, and then you came in and was like, I got this other song. Interesting.
How much earlier, because it really isn't in any of the history, because I have, you know, I got Anthology and, you know, I've been reading all the bio stuff and all of that. Yeah, you'll know I got it by some of the questions I ask you. But how much earlier did you really become big at home before you made it, you know, in the U.S.? How many years did you really pay your dues?
Not many. You know, we certainly didn't have any idea of getting big at any point. We just were doing what we did and sort of success sort of seemed to be natural. Our first single, for example, when we were Le Hoodoo Gurus, we had Leilani on an independent label. I mean, that got a bit of attention outside of, you know, the inner city sort of small, you know, specialty record shop public. There was actually like discos that were playing in the outer parts of Sydney, and we started touring to these places where, you know, normally would have no access. And, you know, so that was the first sort of breakthrough. And then we had our first single, which was Tojo. That didn't do anything really, but, you know, it kind of, you know, that was our first major label. Major minor label single, and then My Girl was actually a top 40 hit, so that was the third single. And you know, from there it just kind of kept, you know, just increasing every record. I mean, I Want You Back supported My Girl, but actually My Girl was probably the bigger hit off that album.
But despite all that, at least in good old America, A&M dropped you after your first record. What were they expecting? I mean, because from my perspective and looking back on it, Stone Age Romeos to this day is legendary, you know, record from that era. Everybody, you know, it's you're an iconic band to a certain, you know, musical audience by a long shot. So why was A&M expecting you to crank out, you know, six disco albums? You know, because that was no, because I mean, we're talking, what was that, 79, 1980?
No,
you know,
actually 84.
What exactly was their problem?
Well, I can tell you what exactly happened was we recorded Marzi's Guitars, and the song that was going to be the lead-off single was Bittersweet. And the A&R guy at A&M thought that it was wrongly constructed as a song, and that he had a better idea of how it should be done, and he took it into the studio and remixed it completely, you know, against our wishes. We said, this is not going to work, and just don't even bother. But he went in. He thought the chorus took too long to come to happen.
You know how, guy.
Yeah, the A&R guy. He knows how to write a song. So he went in and did spend less money on this remix and presented it to us. And, of course, it was a ridiculous, you know, monstrosity.
Remix, of course, it had been entirely re-edited
that's
as
right.
well.
Yeah, that's it.
Cut the song up into bits and pieces, edited it, and put the chorus.
So this A&R guy was really good with an editorial block and tape and stuff.
Yeah,
and he really
he was a guru in the making, you know, in his own mind. So, you know, we heard that it was terrible, we rejected it, and so he had his hurt feelings, and so we got dropped because he was the one that kind of was pushing the band, and then therefore he dropped the ball, and that was the end of us.
Never piss off the A&R guy.
You're always wrong, even when you're right. I mean, everyone knows that Bittersweet is a well-constructed song. It was just no way you could touch that. That's one thing that was not wrong with it.
You've always played a ton of great covers. You know, Bo Diddley, Kingsman, Johnny Cash, and of course, A Hard Day's Night, which people get to hear that live version of if they're smart. Did you always see yourself as, you know, a bar band? Because covers are part of that tradition.
No, I just think we acknowledge the fact that we don't spring out of nowhere and that there's music that we love and we'd like to communicate that through our own songs and through the songs that we listen to of other people. So it's just a way of, you know, showing where we stand.
Before we get into some of the past, is there new material in the offing, or did you just decide, hey, let's go out and play?
Uh-oh, the pressure's on.
Well, I'm supposed to have written a new album, and we were going to record it in January, but
I've been talking to your A&R guy, and he's got some issue. In fact, he's coming in this room right now. Here he comes.
Well, he needs to write some songs first because I haven't got anything right now. No, I'm going to be hopefully getting into the writing when we get off this tour, and you know, start getting that step of the process beginning.
You came out in the middle of the new, what we call the new wave era, but I would say that no one has ever succeeded at categorizing this band. You're one of the few bands that when you go back, and I did spend, you know, go back and read reviews, what they didn't do is say, they're reminiscent of, and that's the thing that everybody manages to do today, is they'll say, well, hearkening back to the new wave era, hearkening back to the punk era, they never categorized your band. They always just said, you know, these are the songs and this is the band. And you've defied categorization, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was another Australian band who were kind of in before us, and they said something once that's described themselves, which I've always thought suited us too, which is we're our own genre. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're like, well, they said it as, you know, they're like Elvis movies. So we're like that, you know, metal as anything.
That's it. The Hoodoo Gurus, the Elvis movie of bands.
That's right. You know, you go see an Elvis movie, you know what you're getting, but you don't quite know what it is compared to other movies. It's its own genre.
It's an Elvis movie.
Yeah, that's
so you don't really care because it's an Elvis movie. It could be a piece of shite and it's an Elvis movie. Were you all self-taught musicians?
Absolutely, yeah. I that's my one of my biggest flaws. I actually never got guitar lessons, so I have this clunky technique that will never improve. But Brad, of course, is a brilliant musician.
I actually did, you know, like Spanish guitar lessons for 7 years.
I hear that in the, you know, Brad, I hear that in the music.
Yeah, I know, you can tell.
And that flamenco tune of yours.
Sombrero gives it away too.
No one could see that. Yeah, that is a beautiful, you know, but how do you get a sombrero in that color? Do you dye it or?
Oh, any local Mexican restaurant can help you out.
And we've got a lot of them here. So you describe Sydney as, you know, the inner city musical ghetto. So for those who didn't grow up in the inner city musical ghetto, what other bands grew up around you back at that time that even, you know, that...
Brad, I think you could take this one away. I mean, there's, you know, the Lime Spiders is one that people would probably know.
Well, the Scientists had settled with their, you know, what
entourage.
People... Yeah, what people regard as, the classic Scientist sound. That's from out of Sydney, although, in fact, that band existed in Perth.
And before that, Radio Birdman, naturally, they came out of Sydney. You know, the Saints came out of Brisbane, but, you know, there's a million sort of bands that twinkled into life and expired, you know, around that time when we were formed, and it was a really fertile era. But there's been, obviously, many times bands before and after that have come out of that little inner city thing. It's kind of a place where the cheaper rental spaces were, so people would all
the
sort
place
of
the tourists don't but, see. The people, I don't think, relate to Australia. You know, the Melbourne sound, the Perth sound, the Sydney sound, Adelaide, they don't relate to those cities the same way. For some reason, England, you know, they've gotten this, but there are very different sounds out of different parts of the country, right?
I think, well, certainly Perth's developing its own monoculture, if you like, or, you know, but, you know, that, there's, in fact, a movie being made about the, all these different bands out of Perth and so forth, which I'm supposedly talking as part of when I get back home, because I'm from Perth myself. So, yeah, there's a bit of it going on. But to be honest, the Hoodoo Gurus never related to much of that ourselves, because, as you say, we were kind of our own world unto ourselves. You know, we actually felt we were in a different universe to most of the other music
that
in the world.
Really, the our modus operandi, wasn't it? The reason the band formed, the reason that we gravitated towards each other, was that we didn't really care for what was happening elsewhere.
And still don't. No. I could tell.
And the feeling's mutual, I gather.
Nobody cares about what you're... I couldn't find this anywhere. When and why did the Le disappear from the name?
The Le disappeared when Brad joined, actually. We were going for about 18 months, but of course only about 9 months playing. It was 9 months of gestation, rehearsal time on weekends, you know, when the band formed. But... it was just one more thing for people to get wrong on the posters, you know, that we had the so many crazy spellings of our name, and we still get them now and again, believe it or not. But
it was
H-U. Oh, yeah. Oh, we had one was... B-U. We were once Two Loose Zulus was one that we got. So, you know, it's just... We just thought, let's not just make one extra thing for them to mess up. So, yeah, it was just kind of easy to get rid of it.
So I'm looking at some of the songs, and I'm thinking of Leilani, My Girl, Another World. These are all tributes to 50s and 60s B-movies. So your songs have all had cinematic stories in the lyrics. They've all been little mini B-movies.
Early on, I was writing pretty much in character, and it was after Stone Age Romeo's I kind of decided I was being a little bit disingenuous to the public by not expressing my point of view rather than some, you know, ironic character's point of view. So that I tried to avoid that a little bit more, and well, completely, to be honest. But still, they pop up every now and again. I mean, Miss Free Love's actually a true story, but it's, you know,
right.
that's a narrative. And then there's Son of a Gun on in Blue Cave. That's a narrative. It's not a true story about me, but it's but they're less about sort of maybe some movie I've seen, and more about a movie I'm making up.
You speak of that awful cover that we've unfortunately all been through of I Want You Back, and yet you didn't really see that song as a hit, did you?
Those things happen all the time. Like, for example, on the album Marzi's Guitars, we recorded the song Like Our Wipeout as a B-side. We had no intention of that being on the record at any point, and we just threw it down, you know, virtually live in the studio. Some, you know, month or so later, I had to do the final vocal on, and it was a Saturday morning. It was kind of like just filling in time just to kind of get this vocal in for this B-side so we can chuck it out a single somewhere. And the producer, you know, I had to finish off the lyrics that morning. You know, I was like, oh, God, I've got to go in, you know, in an hour and sing this damn song. What do I sing? I had, you know, a start on the lyrics, but not complete. And it was just so energetic and natural that, of course, it sort of stuck its head up. I mean, luckily we had a producer who was aware of this, you know, and was actually able to see past our own prejudice towards that song, which was we had no intention. We just thought it was just a, you know, a 12-bar throwaway. And he said, it, you know, this one should go on the record. And we were kind of surprised by that. And then Bittersweet was a, you know, a bit of a hit. And he said, this should be your next single. And we were like, you're out of your mind. And of course, it was a bigger hit than Bittersweet. So you don't always know. I mean, I know that, for example, the B-52's Love Shack was actually recorded as a B-side. It's just... Right. It's one of those things where, you know, the musicians sometimes are a bit, you know, caught up in their own sort of thing, you know. But a song like, for example, What's My Scene, that was...
That's funny. Look right here. There you go. What's that say right there?
Right.
It was huge in Australia, but it didn't make it in the U.S., so there's obviously something cultural, too, that goes on, you know. And I mean, we're all the same human being, but it's interesting that a song like that would be so huge in Australia, but it didn't cross over.
Well, there was two reasons for that. One was the record company didn't really believe in that as a song. They actually thought the big hit was the song with the Bangles, who were big at the time, and they,
right,
that was their money shot, as far as they thought. And we were trying to, you know, turn their heads around to the other thing. But just like that A&R guy from the first album, you know, we wanted to remix Bittersweet. You even when you're right, you're wrong. So they were so convinced that Good Times was the hit that they didn't put any effort into What's My Scene. That was just like a little alternative track for alternative radio, and they didn't really care to push it to mainstream radio. They did a little bit, but it was just, you know, half-hearted. And so that's the first step that was wrong. And secondly, radio itself, if you got to remember, it was incredibly conservative. And that song sounded too brash and out there compared to what they were playing. I mean, you're thinking about, you know, who was our competition? The Police, you know? This is really not in the same category. No. And it wasn't until Smells Like Teen Spirit that radio suddenly unlocked its doors really completely to rock and roll again.
Did you think touring with the Bangles, which you did a lot, was a good pairing? I mean, because you think about what they did and what you do, and it's both melodic and it is both pop. Yeah. There's no question about it. But the audience, I mean, it's an interesting pairing, and you spent a lot of time with them, right?
Well, not only twice, but they were really great tours, and we loved the Bangles and still do. I mean, I saw them when they came out to Australia recently, and it was fantastic. At the time we were hooked up with them, we had the same agent, and the bands actually were in the same marketplace. We were both in college and alternative, and it was only an accident of fate that they released Manic Monday just before the tour began, and they suddenly were pop stars. But at the beginning of the tour, in fact, it was the venues where both bands were equally as popular. And in fact, we had people, in a sense, being a bit snobbish about the Bangles and walking out after we played because that's what they wanted to see, you know. But, of course, by the end of the tour, we're doing arenas and we were just the support group, pure and simple, you know.
It was in reverse, you know. There would be mums with little 10-year-old girls sitting in the front row and we would come out and do Echo Chamber and... Mummy, you know, and be, you know, leaving these halls terrified, you know, and have to like...
These guys are scary. This band is scaring me.
Scary man.
As far as the two bands themselves, we really enjoyed each other's music and enjoyed each other's company. It was just one of those great tours. I mean, yeah, I wouldn't ever say one word against that tour and the whole idea because we just... It's one of my actually favourite memories of touring.
So, you know, everybody who's in this business has to be obsessed with a song. And for me, there I was in L.A. working just for a few months on a consulting thing. So that song came on. And for me, that once a month, that song gets played. And sometimes I play it off the original of the Australian 45. So I'm an obsessed man with that song because I just think it's one of the best songs I have ever heard personally. And I also very much relate to the sentiment.
Right. I don't know if it had like chart success, but it's certainly that album was probably our biggest seller in the States. That's Magnum Come Louder. And funnily, that song has taken on a new lease of life with this NBC show that's coming on soon. And we don't know how the show...
It deserves to open a movie, for crying out. I mean, if that's not over the credits of some, you know, some great comedy, you know, about love...
Get on the wire, talk to your friends in Hollywood. And
send it's licensing time.
And Hugh Grant, Sandra Bullock. Yeah.
Send the checks right now.
No, but I mean, that riff opening up when it comes on the screen, how could that not be, you know?
Well, that's...
I agree.
We'll take the money. Axe Grinder wasn't as successful on radio, but huge in concert.
Yeah, it was one of those songs that we kind of are still puzzled by to this day. I see it as a Frankenstein song. You know, it's made out of body parts that don't seem to coordinate together, but they're stitched together somehow. So it's just one of these weird monstrosities, and we are still grappling with the beast.
And then there is you did something kind of strange.
Okay, one little thing about Axe Grinder, though. I got to say, no one's ever asked me about this, but I always saw it as my sort of interpretation of a rap song. Yeah, it's got a rap sort of. Yeah, the rhythm is, you know, the lyric is kind of rap. So you know.
And yet I see parallels with "Carry On Wayward Son" by Kansas.
And you know, Kansas has some great rap songs. Dust in the Wind as a rap song. This is the thing. I think we're there. Now, you did record in L.A. The Right Time kind of came out of nowhere, right? Mm-hmm. So how many years were you a band at that point? Because that suddenly was like, boom, it was another, you know, heavily played track. And it was a while, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, we'd started in 81, literally. That's the first performance was in September 81 is that Le Hoodoo Gurus, which, as I call that, the, you know, the B.C. versus A.D., you know, in the band's history, when before Brad... was BB. And then, that's kind of when the band became its real sound was when Brad joined in 82. So the first album was 84 and that was 94. So yeah, we had 10 good years of recording and making records. That was our, what, sixth album at that point. You missed out Miss Free Love as well. That was a kind
of... Oh no, that was huge. Oh, I've got the single of that. Yeah. No, I played that heavily too.
Yeah, that was that was the album before that. So yes. Yeah, it wasn't like there'd been a void, but yeah, that was
But you did record that in LA instead of
That's true.
So
yeah.
That was the point of difference.
That was, and that was actually a really great thing because, you know, we actually fell in love with LA at that point. It was one of those places it's a very hard city to come to grips with, and it's yes. such So living there for 3 months, making a record, just made us feel kind of at home, and we still love it to this day.
So this is a cynical thing to say, but you'll get a laugh out of it, I think, because I interviewed him a few years ago. Brad Delp, you know, just passed away from Boston, and yet the first thing that came to mind was for me to play Less Than a Feeling.
I know, it's a sad thing, but, you know, I've been hearing that.
But I didn't think of playing More Than a Feeling in tribute. I thought of playing Less Than a Feeling in tribute. Maybe I was going to talk to you, you know.
But it's a bit like Pete Townsend's My Generation in a way. You know, like the lyrics of that song haunt me now because I'm the one that's going to be being held to account on that lyric because it's saying, what have you been doing lately?
So Spit the Dummy and the Real Deal. This is, you know, you've done the goodbye tour and yet you're saying hello again. So you've done the goodbye tour. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, well, I basically with in Blue Cave, I really love that record and it seemed to me to sort of cap the career, and it sort of had all the strength and muscularity of say Crank with, you know, the Right Time, the previous album, but also a bit of the classic pop elements that we always try to get out as well. So it, to me, it was a perfect marriage, and I was kind of also at that point thinking, well, am I ever going to do anything else besides the Hoodoo Gurus in my life? So it's a little bit of rest, you know, restless feet really, and I didn't want to make a Hoodoo Gurus album that I wasn't 100% you know, obsessed with and focused on, and I just was starting to drift off and wonder what else there was out there. And so I thought we'd just quit while we're ahead and not wait till we kind of run out of steam and no one gave a damn anymore.
And so who kicked you in the pants and said, you know, you should just die?
Well, what happened was we were broken up for 4 years and we were offered to play a gig called Homebake, which is this mega festival every year in Sydney that is only Australian bands, and it's all the latest up-and-comers and, you know, and hard-working superstars of the time and, you know, fairly edgy sort of alternative stuff. It's a really great show, and they said, Hoodoo Gurus, we come out of retirement and play a headline show. And it was too good an offer to refuse as far as, like, you know, the challenge of that and just to see what we could do in front of, you know, basically a new generation of fans. Because I think every 3 years, basically, there's a turnover of you know, of a generation of fans. And so we were just interested to sort of mix it up and see what happened. And we had a great time. The gig was fantastic. But more importantly than that, the spirit of the band was completely intact. There was no feeling of it having, you know, been slightly rusted away in through being apart. And so I had this other material as well that I'd been working on. And it was about another year or so before I finally, you know, put the two thoughts together of, like, that was fun. And also, these songs aren't working with the way you're trying to do them. It's obvious the Hoodoo Gurus are the right outlet for this material. So we reformed in 2 years later and made Mac Chow in 2004, and we've just been playing ever since.
But to fill out the hour, what we do is we've invented a thing we've done with over 100 bands called a musical sandwich. Mm-hmm. It's two of your songs as the bread, but you can have a club. You're the Hoodoo Guru, so you can have a club. You can have three songs just for you.
All right.
And then we pick other ingredients in between by other bands, and I go in with vinyl and CDs and anything you want me to play, and I play it precisely as you ask me to.
Well, I chose two songs, and I think Brad's chosen two, so hopefully that's enough.
That's good.
I can always expand it out, but my choices for absolute what influenced me to form the Hoodoo Gurus was when I was in New York in 1979 as a young man, and I saw the Cramps and the Fleshtones. So I've chosen Human Fly by the Cramps from their first EP and American Beat by the Fleshtones. I mean, you could play any Fleshtones song from any era. I'm
okay,
equally
I'm
happy.
I'm going to do more, but I want to hear Brad's, and then we're going to pick your Hoodoo Guru songs. Then we're just going to riff a few more.
It's tough. I was actually this morning trying to work it out. But just for the hell of it, Born to Lose by Johnny Thunders Heartbreakers and Shonen Knife by Red Cross.
Nice. So what are the Guru songs? What are the three Guru songs we're going to put in the middle of this insanity?
We haven't given no thoughts whatsoever. Well, chuck on If Only, you know, because that's one that you probably wouldn't have heard very much of from In Blue Cave. And have you got any Mac Chow you can chuck on? like maybe
number
17. Number 17 is pretty mad. But what if, or else? What about Domino or what's the other? I was going to say.
Domino may have more broad appeal.
Yeah, it's so kind of.
Than you guys are talking demographics. It doesn't matter.
Well, there's also I love the one that's kind of a bit out there, which is, you know, like unusual for us, that sort of Neil Young one, which is Dead Sea, for example. You know, there's a lot of Max Schau is a really pretty intense album, but it's got some light moments in there. Yeah, it is. I describe it as our Led Zeppelin's Presence album.
There you go.
So it's kind of this sort of oral assault, but actually there is subtlety in there that you can kind of get into if you listen to it a couple of times.
Okay, so now hit me just top of your head a few other songs you want to play by anybody, anything.
Oh, well, you can't go past Ramones, so Blitzkrieg Bop, just chuck it in there. And I'd also, for myself as a kid, the Beatles are my first kind of sensory awareness of music and what it can do, and so I love It Won't Be Long Off with the Beatles, that which I think was a different album here.
Yeah, it was Meet the Beatles here. It's interesting.
Whatever album It Won't Be Long Is Off in the US.
Right. What do you think, Brad? Anything else in your head?
Maybe Mother Earth by the Gun Club, perhaps.
Nice.
And what about City Slang?
No, you could play that. That's actually highly influential to me personally, City Slang by Sonic's Rendezvous Band.
Very nice. Excellent.